Broadcasting on all frequencies from the jungle of death, you're listening to Babes in the Woods.
Welcome back to the jungle of death. We are podcasting yet again. I'm Nyssa, and I'm here with Flumpy and Lindsay.
Hey!
And this week, we are going to talk about beautiful creatures, which, you know, we have some thoughts about. We've all got strong opinions, but I think that we're going to first start out with getting to know you. We're going to talk about what supernatural genres we each prefer. Who wants to start?
I will start by saying, and I know I allude to Buffy at least once per podcast, but I was, I definitely grew up reading vampire stuff more than anything else. And then as a result of, I would describe it as not a cultural overwhelm of vampire stuff, because again, I graduated from high school in the early 2000s, went to college, you know, in the early 2000s. You know, the vampire stuff hadn't hit the Twilight peak yet, but I made myself tired of vampires by reading books like the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series, and really engaging in some of the grosser parts, like the, what are those books? Oh, they're horrible. Those vampire romances by Charlene Harris.
Oh, Charlene Harris.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I got into those for
a
while.
Books.
I live
the
in,
true love books,
thank
yeah.
you. The, they're called the Southern Super Vampire Novels. And I wore myself out on it. I wore myself out on sexy protagonist meets sexy vampire. And I think especially as I sort of gained an idea of what my own political views were going to be, as I grew in that, I got annoyed with the wealth that is inevitably associated with the powerful male vampire, like in the way in which it becomes then the traditional sort of Disney story with a darker edge. And so from there I wound up in zombie stuff, as you guys all know. And that was sort of my gateway to genre was absolutely vampire novels, and it absolutely had to do with penetration, and my own sexual frustration as a teenager.
That's fair.
I think mine tends to be magic of some kind. Like the Harry Potter books were right up my alley. I also read is it Libba Bray or Libby Bray?
Yeah, Libba Bray.
Libba Bray, those books, The Great and, what is it called? The Great and Terrible.
Great and Terrible Beauty?
I'll have to look this up. Yes, yes. And those books I loved, like, when they first came out and led me to a whole other area. It's funny, though, because I really came late to a lot of supernatural books because I did grow up in such a conservative household. Witchcraft was viewed as, like, a very,
Well, but you're in Star Wars.
Well, I read Star Wars.
Like, that's magic.
Yeah, I mean, science it's fiction, totally, like, that's really magic as well, let's be honest.
Yeah. And that's
but, like,
what I like about
somehow,
it.
Somehow, because it was science fiction, it was sort of okay in my house, whereas witchcraft was, like, a thing. Even if it was just magic, it was kind of, like, Harry Potter they didn't give a shit about. But, like,
Puppy, I, think this
I remember
such a cool
the first
point.
Time I watched The Craft and feeling like I was doing something really dirty.
Yeah. Oh, every girl should have a Wicca phase. Every girl. Oh, so good. Teenage witchiness.
Oh,
it's
man.
Just thebomb.com.
It took me a little while to get there, but once I did, I was like whole hog into it.
Yeah, and the thing about sci-fi that I think you're making a really interesting point about here, Flumps, is that I do think it's kind of secular, right? Like when compared to magic. Magic feels religious.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, that has to do, too, with, like, the history of, I think, the church viewing magic and, like, witchcraft. You know, the whole era of witch hunts and things.
Yeah.
So you take, as soon as you put it in space, it becomes acceptable that people have brain powers that
that's
can
true.
Do stuff.
It's science.
Yeah. That's fascinating. What about you, Nyssa?
I think this is kind of funny, actually, because my parents were really, really encouraged all of the genre inclinations that I have. And I started out with, you know, pretty standard high fantasy. I mean, I didn't start with Tolkien, but, like, everything was derivative in that way, you know. All the fairy tales, very much the folklore aspect, I guess, was really my introduction. Like, I have several sets of Grimm fairy tales. I have a super fancy Andersons, you know, all this stuff. And that's what I grew up with. And my parents really, really pushed hard sci-fi, but it was too science-y for me. Like, it felt too, like, shiny chrome and bright lights, and I didn't care. Yeah. Like, I got through a couple of Heinlein books that I really enjoyed, but I, like, didn't ever pursue it further. I can't stand Asimov for more than a short story.
Me neither, but he's also really, I was rereading the Foundation book, the first one, and it's, there's only one female character, and she just shows up, and she's obsessed with jewelry.
Yeah.
Like,
it's, well, I mean, that's part of the thing about Asimov, right? If it's not a stand-in for Asimov himself, then it's not worth time.
The era of classic sci-fi, I feel like it's hard. Like, I really like where sci-fi is moving, you know, like, with things like Battlestar Galactica and super strong female characters. But, I think when we were growing up and finding the books, like, definitely fantasy was a little more women-centered, which may have caused all of us to turn to that.
I think that was what I liked about it, like princesses and fairies and stuff. Like, because, I mean, there are female magical creatures. And, I mean, there are male ones, too. Like, it's not divisive in the same way. Like, I don't think there's any prohibition against there being male fairies, although people think about them, you know, one way. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a thing that I thought about ever, but, like, those were the direction from which I approached all of this genre nonsense.
But, I think that's really interesting, too, in that I think we were all very much led, to a certain extent, by a desire to see female characters. Because every time I hear guys talk about how, oh, you don't need female characters to have an interesting story. But you need an identifier. You need somebody you can identify with automatically. And it's funny because...
Well, but they have them.
Well, no, that's the thing, though. I think they do. And they don't realize that women need them as well. It's kind of that whole thing of, like, when I started watching Big Bang Theory, which is... better than I thought it was going to be honest. It's actually quite entertaining.
Sometimes the jokes bother me because they're not on the level that those characters would be. But
No, exactly.
It's not anybody with a science PhD.
I don't hold the jokes against it at all. It's just hard for me because my husband's a PhD in physics.
Yeah.
And many of our friends are also in those programs. And so when you see these sort of stereotypes parading on screen in bright red tight pants looking like Charlie Brown characters, there's an impulse, I think, to recoil.
No, that's fair. I think it's interesting because they introduced all these female characters, and on the one hand, it's kind of nice to see female characters that are smart and, like, are interested in science. On the other hand, they all have this, like, aversion to nerdy things, like Star Wars or... And I was like,
It's only that they're smart. It's not that they have any, you know, they can't be girly and genre.
Yeah. And they have, like, a whole episode where they get into the comic books and they end up having, like, they end up getting really into the comic books and it's cute, but it's, like, meant to be cute. Like, it's kind of meant to be like, oh, look, they're having an argument about comic books.
Oh,
it's
look,
not meant
the hippo
to be
can
it.
Talk.
Yeah, it's not meant to 100%. Be, like, an actual...
100%. That drives me nuts. That drives me nuts. I mean, like, the worst part about being a girl in a comic book store is the way everyone's just like, oh, look at you.
Right?
Like, there's, like,
look, you're not just reading, like, Princess Fairy Time or whatever. I don't know.
And then
I don't know if there's any, like, super girly comics.
I had the worst getting hit on experience of my life, actually, in a comic book shop where I was checking out... I forget what it was, but it was something like, you know, you're getting into the canon. And so I was reading, like, I want to say, you know, one of the Batmans. Anyway, I was just like,
yeah.
And this guy walked up to me and he's like, well, if you like that, you're really going to like this. Like, let me be your genre.
Right. Let me tell you
Sherpa.
How to do this.
Let me explain this to you, little girl. And I was like, I have read on the internet what I'm supposed to read to be well versed in this. Like, I am not coming into this with no knowledge. And don't treat me as though I am.
And who are you patronizing besides me? Like,
and also stop exoticizing me. Like, I'm really tired of, like, also, like, oh, you're a female nerd. You know, like, that aspect of it. Like, you know, like, that starry-eyed thing that actually, like, alienates you one more time from the conversation by virtue of being attractive, well-spoken, and well-spoken on subjects of genre. It's infuriating.
Right. I just want to read Hellboy. Leave me alone.
Exactly. And, I mean, that's awesome.
All right, so... If we're going to get on target ever, maybe we should move into talking about the plot summary for Beautiful Creatures, which we all saw. It just came out on Thursday, was it? It came out for Valentine's Day?
It did come out for Valentine's Day.
It was a Valentine's Day release.
Well,
along with Die Hard.
I really kind of wish we'd seen that instead.
There was a really funny post, though, on IO9 where they were talking about how this guy wrote the review in advance of seeing it based on the preview, and he was like 99% right.
I feel like
it's amazing. Like, and he puts in all these edits where he's like, this was actually not right. I highly recommend it. I'll link it on the blog.
That doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah.
So we went to see Beautiful Creatures, which is an adaptation of a book of the same name by two ladies, Cami Garcia and Margaret Stoll, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the premise we have here is Ethan Waite, our narrator, I guess. He doesn't really narrate in the movie, does he?
But exactly. No, he does. He does in the beginning, at least.
Okay. So he's our South Carolina boy who feels like an outsider, but is really, you know, an insider in this town that's extremely exclusive, and not exclusive in the fancy way, exclusive in the bigoted way.
Yeah.
And suddenly a new girl comes to town, and she's all dark and mysterious, and he likes her. And then it turns out that she's a witch, sort of.
Burn her!
Right? And, you know, the whole town kind of does that. And it turns out that there's more to it, I guess. There's curses and family relationships and
destiny,
all kinds of problems.
Past lives.
Yeah. All set against a sort of extremely fictional South.
Yes. And I would say that as someone who lives in the South, that was maybe the part of the most upsetting thing about it. Because, you know, like with True Blood, one of the things I really appreciate about it is that it's sexing up rural Louisiana, which you don't necessarily expect, right? But, like, suddenly it's sexy, and
well,
the heat is sexy.
Not a sexy place in real life.
Everyone's sweating. Everyone's wearing cutoffs. All the men are, like, hot and brawny and also capable of swinging an axe. There's something about it that's really good in terms of addressing the fact that it's way too easy for the top part of the country to just shit all over the South and say, nothing about you is sexy, nothing about you is good, nothing you are producing is worth a damn. You know, like, it's way too easy to just say, like, they're rednecks and there's, you know, like, write it off and feel superior about it. And it's, you know, like, it's questionable at this point in our national life why we're doing that. Right. And so I was really stoked about the setting. But then it's like, maybe if they'd set it in the 50s. It might make a little more sense, right? I mean, I'm sure maybe there are parts of the South that are like this. I've just never encountered them.
Well, that was the thing that I got, you know, even in the book, like, all of this idea about what the South is and what it means, like, it's just completely fantastical. Like, it's what, you know, a city person from the North would think the South is like, oh, we don't have a Starbucks because we're too far from Charleston. That's nonsense. There's 3 Starbucks in this town that I live in, and I'm nowhere.
And I mean,
I think that it's one of those things, too, though, where I read an article that said that they based the book to a certain extent on To Kill a Mockingbird because their kids were reading To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right, that was definitely inspirational.
That is horrifying to me.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird because you can kind of see where they're going with it. And I did love the infusions of literature in it, which I liked that these were well read characters.
I agree.
Is fairly rare. I feel like with a lot of young adult, like, they're the cool kids, or they're a nerd, or they're an outcast. Like, you never see anybody in Twilight actually reading a fucking book.
Right.
But,
Wuthering Heights.
That isn't something that they've been assigned for class. Like, all of Bella Swan's preferences are for the 9th grade curriculum of Valparaiso High School. Like, no, I'm not intrigued or impressed by the fact that you like Romeo or Juliet. Like, you know, like, no, I don't think that you liking romances that are almost designed for teen girls makes you like a real character. And in that sense, Lena Duquesne totally succeeds because she is like a character that has preferences that I understand.
Oh man, I did try not to roll my eyes too hard at all the Bukowski stuff, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're in high school.
I mean, when you're a teenager, this man is a god is a reasonable thing to say about Charles Bukowski, and then you grow up.
Yes.
But
they are teenagers, and that is one of the things that maybe we should acknowledge as we move into more, like, critique stuff, is that we were definitely sitting at this movie being, you know, adults.
In our late 20s.
Like, at a teen 20s, 30s. Valentine's Day release movie. Like, we don't like, like, the Jonas Brothers. Maybe we're into the audience.
I think the Jonas Brothers have moved out. I think it's One Direction now.
Oh, that's right. The Harry Styles.
I kind of like One Direction.
Don't even talk
I haven't even heard one of their songs.
Just their songs, not like... They look like 12-year-olds. I don't think they're cute.
Phenomenon.
I just mean, as their songs go, they're really fun and poppy, and I dance to them occasionally.
Taylor Swift.
Do we want to take a break before we move into the...
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's take a break.
All right. Well, then we will be back in a couple minutes. Well, I got a 1931 3-window Q. Now going to react to the film, which we've done a little bit so far, but we're going to discuss further how we felt about Beautiful Creatures. I believe Flumpy had something to say.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's funny because I had two reactions to this movie. For the first maybe half hour of it, I was kind of like, oh, this is a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I kind of invested a little bit in the love story in terms of at least they're two smart kids. I know I was kind of talking about this before. They're at least kind of intelligent. I could relate to the idea of wanting to get out of a small town.
Yes.
I liked that these were kids who wanted more for themselves as opposed to less,
right,
which was really intriguing. However, and I say this with all love and respect, Emma Thompson was terrible in this movie, and I love her so much.
I 100% agree with you. I'm so bothered. Every second she was on screen was horrible. And she's twirling in that dress, and she's just the wrong person for this role. Or maybe this role is just a bad role. I just couldn't even tell, but it was dreadful.
I mean, it wasn't a strong character in the first place. She was very much a MacGuffin, but like, the whole, oh my god, that first reveal. When she's, like, dancing around in the church, like, putting the holy water behind her ears, like, stop it. This is not, this is so far beyond cliche that, like, you're not even worth it.
I don't know if Emma Thompson is the right person to ham. I mean, she hams a little bit in Nanny McPhee. Like, you get some hamming.
But she's surrounded by tiny children who are adorable and also over the top.
There was
like,
also zero chemistry between her and, is it Jeremy Irons?
Yeah. Jeremy Irons.
Their dynamic felt really awkward to me when they were on screen. Like, and you expect actors of that caliber to elevate one another, and it didn't feel like that happened. And this material definitely could have done with something like that. The thing about, you know, last episode we talked about Warm Bodies, which was such an efficient movie.
It was. Yeah.
Beautiful Creatures is 2 hours and 12 minutes, and I felt every painful second of it.
Yeah.
And I felt trapped in that movie theater. I ate mozzarella cheese sticks on purpose.
Oh, man.
I had a very inappropriate reaction.
It made me
had a bottle of water.
And I got a beer.
I just had a bottle of water, too. I had a very inappropriate reaction to the male character. And so I spent most of the movie kind of being like, he put those glasses on. And I just had this moment of, ooh, hello there. Oh, you got your 17. Oh, God. I mean, not in real life, but in this movie. Oh, God. That's a really inappropriate reaction. And therefore, I spent most of the movie kind of staring at him and getting lost in his 17-year-old eyes. And I felt really dirty after that movie.
He's sexy as hell. And it it feels inappropriate. It's true. But I didn't get that from the previews at all. Like, I was watching those previews, and I was like, these kids are kind of unattractive. Maybe it's just that they're tiny proto people. But I like that she wasn't, like, pretty in the way that, like, we've come to expect, like, main actresses to be pretty.
She wasn't, like,
she's very, like, I think she's very striking. I loved her bushy eyebrows and her crazy hair and her bad outfits that reminded me of bad outfits I wore in high school. Like, they were, you know, like, for a film that had its...
super 90s lacy top over the, like, weird tank strip maxi dress.
Yes!
Yeah.
Like, wow, hey, Delia's catalog.
Dude, that long, that long, weird, asymmetrical skirt she was wearing, I was like, yes, with combat boots. Yes, it's on. They were the best parts of this movie, and since they're the central part, you know, like, in that, I think you have to
say, all right.
It's successful. Well, like, I mean, their love story was more compelling than I expected it to be, even if at times it made me, like, feel gross.
Yeah.
Like, the stupid snow scene, I just wanted to punch everyone. I mean, and I know I have reactions like that that aren't necessarily natural reactions, but when things are too, things are too gooey, I have a tendency to punch, and, you know, I wanted to punch.
I think that's
like
reasonable.
With Warm Bodies, you didn't feel that way.
No.
At least from what I remember your reaction. So I feel like that is like a very, it's a testament to the way it was portrayed on screen. Anything that involves reincarnation, I can't help but kind of go, ugh, because it takes away agency from both characters, really. Like, you're destined to be together. that's stupid.
Well, yeah. We definitely want to be together, but as we you know, discover in that same flashback thingy, which happens only twice in the film,
thankfully, because we only get two. There are plenty of outfits and plenty of whirling without inserting actual antebellum shit into it.
Yeah, we had enough banana.
The climactic Civil War reenactment scene.
Oh my lord! I didn't understand why they decided to change the date for the movie. Maybe. Like, I understand you put it on the winter solstice, her birthday, and the battle. Mm-hmm. In the book, it's February 11th instead, which is sort of nonsense date. And so I was really struck by that. And that, like I say, putting it on the solstice, I guess, is important for her. But then that also sort of guarantees there's going to be a moon, which then when she turns it off, like for the whole climactic thing, like she turns herself for both sides by blocking out the moon so it can't claim her. Which also didn't make a lot of sense, but whatever. I hated that ending in the book.
Well, to me, it's one of the more problematic aspects of the mythology, both in the film and in the book, is that, for instance, what's his face? Macon Raven.
Macon Ravenwood.
Lots of O-N sounds, even when they're E-Ns. So he, like, gets to choose, even though he is dark, that he's going to behave like he's light. But if you're a dark female, you just have to be horrible. Like, it's really icky. It takes away a certain aspect of the agency
that
seems to be.
I really didn't appreciate as an addition to the film, because in the book, and I need to stop talking about the book.
No, don't worry.
In the book, there's no gender line. It's not, you know, the female casters get chosen for. It's in this family, every child gets claimed.
That's better.
But across all of caster kind, everybody else picks for themselves. It's just because this family is cursed because of what Genevieve did previously.
That makes so much more sense.
Because that was the price that the Book of Moons took for her trying to bring back her Ethan.
Yeah.
Was like, it gets to decide which of her kids are dark and, you know, her descendants, rather, are dark and which are light.
That just shows again how clumsily handled it was, though.
I was really irritated that she was like, oh yeah, girl casters just can't pick.
Yeah, that part was the worst. That part was the worst. But I thought it was really clumsily handled, and there were other points where, like, they're clearly, you know, there's just not, like, for all of it's 2 hours and 12 minutes, they don't spend those minutes as well as maybe they could. So all of a sudden, they're in the special library, which, of course, as a librarian, was my favorite part. Like, they're in the caster library, and he's like, was Macon Ravenwood in love with my mom? I just feel like he was. And what indication have we had, haven't read the books to think that.
The way he talked about it, he was like, oh, she was a lovely woman, and then, of course, I only knew her through her work. So, you know, something's up, but, like, not, like, let's get it on in the crazy library stuff.
Right? Yeah, and it's just, the thing about it was, Macon Ravenwood was such a dick to him that I'm not getting, like, Snape feelings about it. I'm not thinking, oh, well, he's agreed to protect this kid. I'm thinking, well, he's trying to give this kid depression and then later cover him in vines and strangle him.
I think that was my favorite scene, and it's terrible, but, like, watching him, and maybe it was just because the actor handled it, I think, really well, but that scene where he starts going into what his future is going to be, and it's this terrible, depressing future, I thought that was really good in terms of, for teenagers, when you are that kid who just wants to get out of the small town, that is your worst fear. Yeah, right? That whole scenario.
That happen instead because something's going to go horribly wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was really interesting because that doesn't happen in the book at all. And I'm not really sure what they were trying to accomplish for Macon's character, like establishing what his powers are. But I guess they never went into that really.
No.
Like, he's not a caster at all.
It's a really compelling scene that doesn't necessarily belong in the movie. And you know,
it was really good though.
I loved it. It's like maybe the best scene in the film. You know, like there's all this extraneous garbage where like what's her face? Ridley is changing hair colors and looking like a film noir. And like you're like, what is this accomplishing? I already know
what
that you seduced
this kid.
What was that
dress she was wearing when she first showed up? Oh my goodness.
Right.
And then why is her, you know, like I'm just, are you wearing wigs? Are your magic because you can grow your hair? You know, like
yeah, I don't know.
Your power is wigs. Really her your power is, you know, like that felt really extraneous. Like, they didn't focus enough. I felt like, for instance, that actress, excuse me while I consult the IMDb page, you know, Emma Thompson was wasted. Viola Davis was wasted.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Violet is definitely wasted.
You know, that was one thing. The Viola Davis character was two different characters in the book, and there was only one thing about their amalgamation that really bugged me. Like, otherwise, they did a decent job splitting the two of them, but then to have her be the keeper of the library and then say it's a thing that a seer has always done.
Yeah.
Like, I guess it was one of those simplifications for the movie that, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, I just don't think.
Sort of like, well, this is how it is, you know, but it was irritating because the whole point in the book is that, like, one mortal gets to know about all this stuff.
Yeah.
But
and that's it.
To quote Team America World Police, what we really could have used was a montage, which maybe told us. Exactly. Like, there were a number of things that could be accomplished in a montage. We could have learned about the different kinds of casters, which, as I understand it, is kind of important in these books. Like, that you're something. You know, like, yes, you're powerful, but you're also, you have a kind of power.
You have a
major. You have a concentration.
Like, there's a reason that you are like this and that somebody else is different.
Yes. You know, like, that would have been helpful. You know, and, like, there could have been, like, a montage.
Oh, we're all magic and we can do whatever.
Where we found out about, like, this former generation of people, which is also important in the book.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just, they were so obsessed with creating these little scenes of dates, I think, because this is a Valentine's movie for tweens, again.
Yeah.
That, you know, stuff that would have really helped with the cohesiveness of the narrative was lost.
Yeah.
Like, why
well,
she,
and even,
you know?
I felt so many times, every single scene had somebody going, you shouldn't be together, but we want to be together. Like, every scene, I felt like somebody was telling them, stop doing this, and they would say no. And it just got really annoying.
Yeah.
It was pretty old.
Got old fast.
I think one of the things that was distracting was that, you know, we did just see warm bodies, and what one of the things about it that we liked was how, you know, immersive it was.
Yeah.
It was this whole world that was built and complete, but it didn't need to explain itself to us.
Yeah.
Because we saw what we needed to see, and we understood. This movie kept explaining things, but not in a useful way, in a like, oh, I only want to spend 3 seconds of screen time on this, so I'll just gloss over real fast and we'll move on. Like, nothing felt real.
Mm-hmm.
I would, yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, oh, he has this power and I'll just accept this. Oh, she can do this. You know, I understand now. Like, it was, oh, this is blah, blah, you know, I didn't.
And it just felt.
We'll talk that instead of shown.
Again, because you don't know their kinds of power, it felt like everyone had limitless power. And for instance, in the books, you know, it's explained that a natural is a kind of witch. Like, whereas in the book, when they say, she's a natural, I was just like, like, it's like me at the batting cage. Swale it away, you know, sometimes you're just good at a thing.
But no,
you don't get any of that.
It's supposed to be a specific subset of powers. But
it's really confusing. I found it very confusing. To the point that it was frustrating, and then it went on forever, and then it had a Civil War reenactment sequence so that everyone could wear ridiculous outfits to match the ridiculous sorcery outfits, which were also happening simultaneously at her graduation ceremony thingy, where the moon was going to make her bad or good.
Right.
I'm confused. Totally, so wait, the natural thing, is that why she can grow things?
Yeah. She has powers, basically.
I don't understand why they didn't just, like,
Why didn't they just say that? Like, why didn't they just tell us, hey, there's different kinds of witches? Oh, because
they kind of hinted at it, and it's not until you brought up the natural thing that I remember him saying, oh, can you always grow things? Yeah. Like, which now makes a little bit more sense, but, like, she should have been like, I'm a natural. That means blah, 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 blah.
Well, because she explained that Ridley's a siren. Like, she can make people do what they want.
Yeah,
which
was so confusing why she was specifically a siren and we didn't really get anything from anybody else.
She could have been flipping through pages, you guys, during our helpful montage, and it could have been each page was, you know, naturals.
Right, and then fade in of somebody's face. Like,
you know, like, hit me with it a little bit, because it's a movie.
Right.
Also, I feel like what this movie tried too much to do was emulate Twilight in a weird way, as opposed to really embracing the kitschiness of it. I think that's why it didn't work as well, is because it was stuck somewhere in between Labyrinth/Dark Crystal territory with the terrible special effects and Twilight. And I think if they'd gone more towards, like, just really, like, upped the campiness a little bit, it might have worked out a little bit better. I might have forgiven some of it, but because it was so, it wanted to be lighthearted. Like,
if they had just taken a little less seriousness, I think it would have been much more successful and much more enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I mean, certainly it doesn't help that we saw the most successful young adult zombie rom-com of all time recently. Yeah. But it wasn't funny. And because there wasn't,
he was funny. Like, I really appreciated the charmingness.
He brought a lot of charm to it, but, like, he at times, you know, and again, I think part of it is that teenage earnestness thing.
Yeah.
So, like, I would have loved it, you know, like, when one of the more successful interactions between Emma Thompson and Jeremy Irons' characters came before we knew that she was Seraphine. And he's, like, making fun of her hat. And, you know, like, that sort of stuff. Like, that stuff was, you know, like, it was a little mean-spirited, but I was kind of into it by that point in the movie because I was like, at least someone's saying something that requires, you know, like, a little wit to it. Because everyone else was, I feel like half the movie was just people making startled faces about the fact that they were together. You can't be together.
Oh, she's different. Like, yeah, we got that.
It would have been really interesting to have the reveal of Seraphine come much later. Maybe even when she's trying to get into his house, like with the cookies, and having it be that she's bound, and it's that moment of like, wait, oh, holy crap, well, that's her?
How about this? Why does no one ever tell the people that it matters to you that the mom is actually an evil witch? Like, oh, I'm sorry, Lincoln, but your mom's actually an evil witch. Oh, I'm sorry, young man, whose name I forget. What's our main character's name?
Ethan.
I'm sorry, but your friend's mom is an evil witch right now. She's a skin suit. Like, you know, no one ever tells
anyone
anything.
She's been possessed by a horrible being.
Which is, which is my number one gripe in most horror movies, is that people don't communicate well enough. And so that was a problem in this
more
movie particularly.
Those.
Yeah, I thought that was a weird streamline choice, like, for her to reveal herself to us as well as to Macon so early. Mm-hmm. Like, because it does come at the very last second, literally, in the book. Like, she's about to destroy everyone, and then she steps out of Link's mom and is like, oh, by the way, it's been me this whole time.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one more question I have for you, Nyssa, because I read the book, but much like this film...
Did you read any further books?
I read synopses of further books.
Okay, I didn't do that.
So I need to know what happens. It's just a problem for me where I have to know how things go. But... question. So in the flashback, we learned that the end of this battle basically happened when Evangeline, or whatever her name is, went evil and, like, killed everyone, right?
Genevieve
killed everyone. Yep. We're reenacting a war scene where a witch shows up and kills everyone. I'm sure, like, she wiped everyone's memories, but that also wasn't made clear, so it was hilarious.
None of that happened in the book. Like, none of it.
Wait, none of what happened?
Anything after her attempt to revive her Ethan fails. Well, I mean, it succeeds for like a minute and a half, and then he dies again, and she has turned evil. By which we mean her eyes have turned gold, and so she's been claimed for the dark or whatever. And it takes a while to figure out what else the book took, you know, what the price was. But after that, she just doesn't really do anything. And she certainly doesn't march out in front of a line of soldiers and kill them.
I was thinking, too, that...
They'll, like, march into the house and kill all the rest of the people. Like, none of that happened.
Another character actor that I thought was wasted in this is Kyle Gallner, who you may know better as Beaver from Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars.
He's a very charming actor, but in this, he just feels like he's a character that should have been combined with another character, so we had a more...
Yeah.
Like,
he plays
Larkin Ravenwood. He plays the actor that shows up just to be.
Why did they get a
Macon.
Good actor for that character? They didn't do any of the stuff with him. Like,
and
he existed.
His relationships feel totally forced. The only character development we have on him is that while the table is spinning as Ridley and Lena face off, he's still eating because he's cool as a cucumber under pressure. And it's just. This film is a mess. This film is a mess to me. It's a bad collage with words like sparkle in it inside a teenage girl's locker.
I do wish that I'd seen the movie before I read the book because I spent the entire time going, why did they change that? Like, this is sloppy. What's going on here?
But,
and I kind of wish that I'd done it in the reverse order because I usually like movies better if I've seen them first.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It was just not strong.
No.
I don't think.
Well, and I think, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before, but in terms of adaptations, if you can capture the spirit of a book and the spirit of the characters, usually it doesn't really matter if you change, I feel like, plot points. So that's the difference, is like, this movie was a mess in terms of theme and character development. That's the biggest problem.
Right. And it's not like the book was the most solid thing on those either, so I feel like being worse than that is, you know, what were you doing? But where did you spend your time?
I was going to say, though, something that occurred to me just now is that even though I like witchcraft a lot in literature, I've seen very few films that deal with it successfully. Like, let's eliminate Harry Potter from the discussion.
Yeah.
What do we have left?
I mean, you have The Craft, which I really like, but is also super 90s teenage angsty.
Yeah.
But I like it in terms of, I feel like it's more of a... it has that more like Wiccan ideal of it's a bonding experience between women, and that it becomes more about the relationships between women, that movie does, than about anything else. The issue is that then there's a dude who enters into it and he becomes a huge aspect of it.
Right. But wasn't there a movie like that a couple years ago that I didn't see? A group of boy witches.
I saw that one. It was like The Covenant or something like that.
And
it had Tim Riggins in it. Taylor Kitsch.
Tim Riggins is in that movie?
Yes. Being hot.
I may have to rent that
And
movie.
Then it's all set in...
you say that now, but you didn't watch John Carter.
I watched it. I watched it, and I enjoyed those abs enough for all of it. But what I was going to say is it's set in The Covenant, I think is what it's called, and I will look that up. Give me a quick second. It's interesting. It's good. It's not good. It's terrible. But it's set in New England in such a way that they all look like an Abercrombie and Fitch catalog in the best way the entire time, which I appreciated. I was just looking up movies about witchcraft, and I will tell you the ones that I think are worth a damn, but it's very few. Hocus Pocus is good.
Oh, I love that movie.
Bedknobs and Broomsticks is awesome.
Yeah.
Also excellent.
The Witches is great.
The Witches is great.
Yeah, all right.
And then, but then you've got like, I'm going to exclude, like, I like The Witches, the film with Angelica Houston, the adaptation of the Roald Dahl movie. Book, excuse me, internet, for saying that. But then you've got a bunch of crap. Like, I mean, like, Practical Magic is okay, but it's not a good movie. Like, I feel like part of the reason I was excited about this, and part of the reason it gives me hope is maybe we'll move into a witchy era where we can see this done well. Because
that's true.
Wasn't there a Sabrina movie that wasn't very good?
It was terrible. I actually watched it a few days ago.
And then there was The Worst Witch, like 100 years ago, which is equally awful.
Yeah.
Don't even give me that face, Swampy.
Well, and then they had no. I was thinking about how witches. I was trying to think of Witches of Eastwick. Was a show that came out a couple of years ago,
and there was the movie adaptation in the 80s. It's actually based
It's supposed to be a really good book. I haven't read it yet.
John Updike.
It's Updike, I know.
It's we all know how we feel about Updike. It's so crazy to me that he wrote a book about witches, but I guess it was the 80s, so you could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, that's my thing, is I think that's what magic is. It's weird, but one of the things that works really well about the Harry Potter books, in terms of magic, and what I think works really well in most books or any kind of media that deals with magic or witchcraft, is that they have rules to a certain extent. It's not just that they have limits to their power. It's that...
Right. But there's a system.
Yeah, and there's like an ethical side to it, which I didn't feel like was really established with Beautiful Creatures. Because Macon was dark initially, you kind of don't believe in his morality.
And then there's the point that's made too by Alina when she's claiming herself that everything is light and dark. So you lose any sense of the credibility of the light in that. Which, you know, like it's an interesting point to make, but like then what's the point of being one or the other?
It would have been better if they'd had a character who was all light, but who did questionable things
who represented the light in any sort of way that wasn't like, oh, he's choosing to be light for now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
But I will say, too, that I agree with you, Flumpy, that the most successful written versions of magic, like, give you a set, like, limits. An idea right, that you understand.
There's always rules. There's always a way that this magic system works.
And definitely this film didn't have it. One of the things I'm excited about in this coming year is that they're working on a pilot of that book I really love, The Magicians. And The Magicians is interesting because they say, like, magic is your ability, like, it's controlled finger movements. And they're incredibly precise. And it sounds a little silly, right? But it feels so good after... You know, like, even in Harry Potter, when she's like, well, you say the spells, but after a while, you can just say them in your head, because you're powerful enough. Like, it takes it, and it gives it limits, and it makes it thoughtful, and it says, these are the things that you have to do if you're going to perform magic. And yes, there's natural aptitude, but you're also required to do precise things. I found that really, you know, like, it's nice to have magic that has limits that I understand, and isn't just, like, now lightning is shooting out of a wand.
Right.
Yeah.
Do we think that, like, stage magician movies count?
I was just going on witches.
The Illusionist?
Yeah, like, The Illusionist is really cool, because that is the science is magic thing, right? Like, that's Tesla. Yeah.
That's kind of the
The Prestige.
Yeah. But that's, well, either one. The Illusionist is maybe more, like, magic, but it's still kind of the same idea in that it's a very dry take on magic, which I kind of enjoy. Like, it's a very, it has this aspect. One of the things that I like about The Prestige, at least, is that Hugh Jackman's character, no matter how despicable he can be, there's this element to him that you kind of like, which is that he wants to believe real magic exists to a certain extent. Like, that's kind of a really cool idea.
What I like,
his attitude makes him the one you're rooting for, even though they're both kind of terrible people.
Christian Bale's character really is arguably the better.
Right, like he's a better person.
In the end, you're like, at least he can love something. At least, like, the two of them, like, separately, it's only because they're so committed to this trick that they become horrible people, but outside of that, they're really good people.
His commitment to being a bad person makes Hugh Jackman the better magician.
David Bowie as Nikola Tesla, P.S., is, like, the most inspired casting I've ever seen. Like, I was so turned on by him that I could imagine myself just throwing my panties at him and him being Nikola Tesla and saying, no, ladies, because his magic power was abstinence.
His manner of
But I was going to say, too, like, in the Magic as a System school is also the His Dark Materials trilogy.
Yeah.
And I think that is a really wonderful and fully realized world, again, because of that as well. Like, you're measuring dust, and everyone has a daemon, and you understand these things. Like, there are limits.
Yeah. There are so many books with, like, really great magic systems that just make sense, because there's rules, and this is what works, and this is what doesn't.
And that's what I think is missing in cinema that deals in magic. Yeah. And that's what I'd like to see next.
I feel like a lot of people who are making movies feel like there's not time to, you know, explain these things, but you don't always have to explain them. You have to demonstrate them. Like, you have to let us see them happening.
Well, much like, and I mean, I hate to keep going back to this, but because we did just see it, like, with Warm Bodies, I think talking about that world, there are rules definitely within the zombie world that you get to see that are explained. Even the Bonies, which is, it's done largely through narration, but it's done in this way, it's a quick, it could have been a throwaway line, like, if you didn't know anything about plotting for films, but seeing, like, a Bony, and you, like, see somebody doing something, you see somebody becoming a Bony, you have him say, they'll kill anything with a heartbeat, I mean, so will I, but at least...
Right, like, he makes a joke, so there's a reason to listen to that line.
But it takes literally, like, three lines, and then you're automatically, a level there. And you kind of also, as you get to go on, as you start to hear his thoughts, you start to realize that it's not just that, oh, everybody gets to that point. It's that there's a level of hopelessness that comes with that.
Like, you learn more about it as the story goes on. Like, as it relates to the people you care about in the movie. And, like, I don't know. Just like you learn about this particular brand of zombies throughout the movie, you learn that, you know, they have a sense of smell, but it's not strong enough to tell that she's just got a little bit of zombie on her. Like, they have, you know, they can hear you, so that's why they'll come. Like, but they can't tell the difference looking at you, you know, like.
Yeah.
You learn all the different variations, just, and nobody talks about it.
No.
It just happens.
And I mean, it helps that we have a knowledge of zombies in our culture, but we also have a knowledge of witches in our culture.
Right, like we have.
You can pull back, there's a basis of it, so you're not starting from scratch, but yes, you can tweak the mythology to meet your needs, and that's why Warm Bodies was so successful. Like, completely changed a lot of our conceptions of, like, what being bit by a zombie means.
Right. You know, and it took a lot of zombie rules.
It was a refreshing thing.
I think also part of what made Warm Bodies a little bit more successful was that it really simplified the story.
Yeah.
Like, it took a story that could have been really complicated, could have had a lot of different side stories, and I think that's where Beautiful Creatures kind of fails, is that there's just so much going on. Like, if they'd just gotten rid of the reincarnation crap and, like, taken that out, like, you could have just had this ancestor fell in love with a boy, and when he died, she gave up her soul to be able to, you know, or something along those lines. Like, there's already this aspect of, like, which is what essentially they're doing, but they don't want to.
We could have even just seen it happen, hitting the locket, and understood. Oh, well, if you bring someone back from the dead, you're probably breaking some sort of rules, if this is any indicator. Because, like, we have brains that work on basis of logic, you know?
Yeah.
Right. I think that's a good point to take a break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about some gender problems in supernatural romance, and especially in this film, since it's what we're nominally talking about. And so we'll see you in a couple minutes. Welcome back again. We are still talking about Beautiful Creatures, and now we're going to go into the gender issues that we had with this and with supernatural romance as it's, you know, recently been represented in general.
I wanted to say, for starters, that I do want to give this film and the book credit for doing a certain reversal in terms of she is the one with the supernatural powers, mm-hmm. He is the one who is fainting all the time.
Yeah.
I definitely appreciated that. I appreciated that she's the powerful one. But,
right? Yeah.
There's a lot about it that's questionable, and there's a lot about it that's still, as we discussed earlier, in the film version, though not in the book version, she has no control over her destiny, it seems like, until she does seize control, which is, of course, great. But the idea that women do not get to choose, men do, Megan Ravenwood does. It's a very problematic idea to have.
Awful, yeah.
To sort of front load in the story.
There's also this sense that she would have her. It's weird, and this is the thing that I get a little annoyed with in terms of magic. Usually, when it's attributed to women, is that a lot of times it's tied very much to their emotions.
Yeah,
and this idea that losing the love of her life would cause her to go dark. However, losing her uncle, who's been her caretaker, who she actually seems to grieve more for.
Right.
Really?
I thought that was done not very well in the movie, because in the book she's super, super attached to him.
And, yeah.
Like, it makes sense that she was, like, she's shocked when he dies.
In the film, he's basically a douchebag that makes one sacrifice. Like, the rest of the time, he's just, I don't even know, he's just setting traps, making that poor boy think that he's going to have to stay in that town forever.
And you're like, okay, whatever.
And wearing
she's
silly outfits.
Really torn up about it, and you're like, why, though?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and there's this sense, too, I think, of, like, he has to show her the light. He has to show her the... I just would have really liked it if it was kind of like, she'd been told this whole time, you have no choice in the matter, and she was like, fuck this shit, I'm choosing. Like, this is my decision second.
Yeah.
That's a much more
empowering
line.
I would have liked
it
if that had been more her choice, and rather than him giving her the idea.
Yes.
Right.
Let's see. What else is problematic?
The idea that Ethan is somehow her protector in some way. Like, he mysteriously has some kind of power that is never fully explored.
That's true.
Line from Grandma about, like, oh, it's not the house protecting her now. It's this kid. Like, what?
Yeah.
What? Why? Why does the dude have to protect her? And also, what's going on? Like...
Also, there's a sense of... Especially
since she's the powerful one. Why does he have to have powers just so he can fulfill your ridiculous gender roles?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like...
There's also this sense of, when we talk about, like, the lack of agency, it's... And granted, this is done for both of them because she also takes away his ability to make decisions about this situation by
erasing
taking away his memories.
Yeah, which doesn't happen in the book, and I thought it was weird.
I actually kind of liked that aspect of it in terms of, I would have preferred it if they had not tacked on the very end where he, like, remembers.
Where he remembers again, yeah.
I kind of liked this aspect of she, which I know they did that because they can, that way they can do a sequel.
Yeah.
But I really liked the idea that this would have been kind of like a melancholy ending to the movie.
Right.
I was like, oh, this is kind of a redeeming, like, very brave thing to do.
Right. With
these characters, and it would have said something about teenage love.
Yes.
I feel like in that,
yes.
you don't end up with your high school. It's like some people do. Some very few people though now end up with their high school sweetheart.
Right.
You go away to college and you get these new experiences. And
right. She was gonna let him go away to college.
Like, yeah, and like she was making, when they talk about like sacrifice, which became this big heavy anvil at the end of the film. Yeah. It would have been really nice to have it be that her sacrifice really did get
him back. Have it be a real sacrifice instead of, oh, everybody came back to life. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, and Macon Ravenwood died, but everyone had told us throughout the film that he was old and weak anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? Like, they set it up so hard, it's really heavy-handed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I completely agree with you, Flumpy. I would say it's not exactly a gender roles issue, but I do have a problem with the dominance of young adult stuff. When it's so much, it seems about like true love and the notion that you're going to marry this person, like,
right,
and then marrying this person is what makes it okay.
Crush is gonna be the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, excuse you. Well, I remember my first crush, and that would have been poor decision making.
Yeah. Right. But my other thing with it is that she, I think the only issue with it in terms of like gender roles is that she never seems to really want for. She doesn't have a goal.
Yeah.
She doesn't have
a future.
There's nothing for her. Like, there's everything for him. And on the one hand, he's supposed to be the audience, the one that the audience identifies with, so that sort of makes sense.
He's the first person, like, yeah.
But in terms of for women, like, it's kind of like having this power is enough. If she stays in this town for the rest of her life, who cares? Like,
right.
And she's going to be an outcast no matter what. Well, and that's
like,
the thing that was like.
The implication is that he has, you know, been powerful and lived in this town and spoken to no one for, you know, who knows how long, and it's for him, like,
but it's like she's kind of damned to this really depressing existence of being a town outcast and all this kind of stuff. We never see her looking at colleges. We never see her, which would have been actually really nice in terms of she's also
like
looking
you still
at
have
colleges
to be a person. yeah
well, even just having this moment of like, that's like her faraway dream she knows is never going to happen type thing.
Right,
but she has that aspiration.
She wants to. Well, and that's a big deal in the book, is that she wants to be like normal high school girls. So there's all the stuff that she wants to do and like tries to do for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would have been good to see in the movie instead of her just like, oh, it's always like this and nobody cares, blah, blah, blah. Like having her, you know, be a person at all instead of we find out, oh, well, if you turn dark, they kind of kick you out of the family, but not really.
Yeah.
Everyone's just really annoyed when you show up for Thanksgiving.
Right, like, they just don't like you. And, you know, if that's already happening, then, hey, what have you got to lose?
Yeah. Like, yeah, 100%. She's more fully realized than so many young adult heroines I see currently. And so I want to give her...
It was early at the beginning that I thought she was going to be, you know, a pretty good character.
But she's really...
actively surly and, like, ridiculous.
It's like we hit a point, and she is a static character. Like, and that's what you come to realize, is she's exactly the same throughout. And, like, even though there's this notion of the sacrifice she's made, the fact that he does come back at the end completely negates that as a possible
right.
character development.
It invalidates the entire exercise. Like.
And it's very questionable to me. And, like, the notion, too, that because you have this great power and with the great power comes responsibility, Spider-Man factor, you're then, like, basically condemned to live in a town where everyone hates you. That part is also never addressed. Like, why not have, like, a town catharsis where they come to realize that, like, magical beings have
being
been living in our midst.
Assholes is maybe the wrong way. Like,
you know, and, like, you know, like, the notion of the banned books. Like, it's just, we're not dealing with any sort of real arc. We don't see anyone come around and make a real change.
No one changes at all.
And it's not just a problem with the female characters, it's a problem with the male characters. Right. So
the situation changes, but that's it.
At the end, where we've had so many awesome reversals, where she's been the strong one, where he's been fainting, where she's been rescuing him, at the end we have him coming back to town to rescue her, which also negates that aspect.
Right?
And that is hard for me.
We have so much of that already. You know, we have so many examples of, you know, this white knight crap that's already thousands of years old. Can we please get over it?
There's something to be said, and I think there's, in genre specifically, because maybe it's such a male-dominated audience, or at least it's perceived to be a male-dominated audience.
Some parts of it, anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's this aspect, though, of I've heard a lot of kind of, you know, explaining of, well, it happens to male characters, too, but the problem is when
you can think of one example, that's not the same thing.
Well, also, though, it's this idea of, but the most prominent person it happens to is female, which means that you forget about those male characters and the things that happens to them because the most prominent character it takes place, you know, all of these circumstances surround is female. In your mind, it's hard not to break this idea that it's because she's a woman.
Yeah.
Like, it really is. So it's kind of one of those things where, I mean, the decision-making, it would be very different if the whole family had to go through the curse and this idea and not just women and women don't have a choice. But there is this aspect of, in terms of, like, lack of agency, it's very weird. It's just very strange that this movie, I can't believe that these movies get made anymore, like, in terms of how nobody sees that they're problematic, and yet then I forget that we've been, you know, gender programmed, and I could go off on that for ages, so I'll stop now. The gender programming that's taken place and how we kind of view this as very acceptable storytelling.
Yeah.
Not just acceptable, desirable.
Yeah.
This is apparently what people want to hear about, even though it's completely unrealistic and, like, it's difficult. It's damaging.
It's fascinating, you know? Too, that it's the norm in this, right?
Yeah.
Like, where it's not the norm anywhere else. And I realize that maybe it's escapism. It's the notion that maybe, like, you know, like, we all want to find true love. So why not make it happen earlier so it's easier or whatever? You know, like, we all want to, like, you know, like, have – but, like, it comes back to me, actually, with her staying. Like, this notion that, like, the supernatural – all supernatural characters in our modern writing have become – like, associated with wealth, right? Like, you're supernatural, so you're sitting on top of a pile of money, so you never have to do anything again. And I think that's what I'm tired of, personally, as a genre reader, and what I'd like to see more of is sort of the show The Supernatural, to throw another crux in. I am not talking about supernatural things now, but they fight supernatural beings. They are not supernatural beings, but they are not getting paid for it. Buffy, the same way. You know, like, you have to make ends meet. And I think it's more compelling storytelling. Like,
isn't
that
a thing for at least part of the True Blood stuff also? Like, some of those people don't have much, like, the vampires do because they're immortal, but
she's a waitress.
Other weird people don't.
And so it's one of the motivating factors is sometimes she gets offered money to do things that she doesn't want to do, and she does them. And it makes it more interesting. It makes it more relatable. And so with Beautiful Creatures, I would say another thing that I'm tired of is rich witch families.
Right.
Yeah.
Damn those rich witch families.
Rich witch families. Just getting legacy.
Well, I guess we have that some in Harry Potter. I mean,
Malfoy. Harry Potter has that pile of money.
Right.
Then you've got the poor family, but there's still, like, old magic in the form of Ron, the Weasleys.
Old magic, but not old money.
And then you've got Mudbloods.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she deals with it. She tells us a complete story.
Right.
Right? Like, with her classes in the wizarding world. And that's what makes that better than this.
And that plays a really big role in terms of the people who generally have the more money. Like, Harry Potter is kind of portrayed as the exclusion to the rule, like, everybody else who has money is a snob and hates people who don't have money, and so he's kind
of
like
not having money.
That's exactly what it is that he grew up poor and then comes into money, and it's very much, I mean, it's funny because I think it definitely, like, jives more with a particular view of the world. Granted,
well,
it's
definitely
a world that I think
thing, like,
really,
you know,
ties
because
into
he's
money.
A good person, he comes into money later.
Yeah.
The morality tale that goes with money, oftentimes.
Right.
Which I think is really great and would be nice to see I think, I mean, it's really easy to talk about Harry Potter in terms of, there were 7 books, so there's a lot that they can establish in that time.
Right.
But there
7
is
books
this,
and 8 movies, not and all 8 necessarily movies. The same.
But it's kind of that idea of, I felt like there were themes outside of magic that were explored,
yeah.
whereas I feel like there isn't as much of that in a lot of mainstream genre. Which I think is what makes it fail sometimes.
And I think we're going to talk about this a little more in our next episode. But I just, part of me wonders if I'm just becoming more of a curmudgeon or if these things are becoming less well-written.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, because they're becoming more popular, I think that, you know, more of the bad ones are getting through. Like,
that's
I think
point,
that's
actually.
Part of the issue is, like, more of the, you know, publishers are scrambling to keep up with the trend, so they let more and more
Schlock.
Crap. Through, whereas it had to be stunning in some way. Well, it didn't have to be. I mean, there's plenty of shit from 20 years ago, too.
Yeah.
You know.
But it was
more
like,
likely that things...
It was, like, in the basement, right? Like, it was in the, with those crazy covers.
This is going to be my optimistic thought for the day. Not my only one, but this is the one on this subject.
Just the one.
That now there's this realization that women are much more interested in genre and... sci-fi and fantasy,
right,
and that these are kind of stumbling blocks because Hollywood's not used to aiming this type of fare at young girls, especially not like girls who, you know, not like the outcast, but this is like a mainstream thing now. And so these are kind of the stumbling blocks of figuring out how to make good films that can also be targeted towards women. They're ensconced in these worlds, especially like with witchcraft or even like vampirism, that traditionally have been kind of viewed through male eyes.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
That's kind of my hopeful thing is that these are the precursors.
Yeah, maybe this is just the foothills, like, and we've got a couple bad spots, but like we'll get through.
Yeah.
We'll help.
That's a really hopeful note. Yeah. And I like it. I like it,
right?
Ladies.
I sort of like it as an ending place, actually. Like, I don't know if we can go any higher than that.
I don't think we should try.
Well, all right, then. I guess we're going to call it for now because Flumpy has just reached the pinnacle of our happiness for today. So have a safe trip out of the jungle of death, and we will see you again soon.
Bye, guys.
Bye.